Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The CDC is recommending nearly all Californians return to masking indoors, including those vaccinated. These new federal guidelines narrow in on regions with high or substantial COVID transmission. CalMatters did the math and found that it includes 45 of the state's 58 counties, or about nearly 96% of California's 40 million residents. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky told reporters yesterday in a press briefing that although breakthrough cases are rare, when they happen, vaccinated individuals can spread the virus if they become infected. Walensky also said COVID-19 hotspots are generally where there are low vaccination rates.
In areas with substantial and high transmission, CDC recommends fully vaccinated people wear masks in public indoor settings to help prevent the spread of the Delta variant and protect others. This includes schools.
Joining us now to help us understand a little bit more about the new guidance is Dr. Dean Blumberg. He's the chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Medical Center. Dr. Blumberg, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks. Good morning.
Dr. Blumberg, I think the first time I interviewed you on COVID was January of 2020. I just want to check in and get a sanity check. How are you doing?
Oh, my God. January 2020. I can't believe that it's been that long.
I honestly was just thinking about it right before I was about to chat with you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know. It's hard. It's hard to believe what we thought way back then when we weren't wearing masks, where we were looking for a handful of cases and where we thought you could only get it if you traveled somewhere like to China and we had the travel restrictions just starting. So we've come a long way since then. It's a completely different world, isn't it?
It really is. And it's continually evolving. It's such a fluid situation where I feel like sometimes my sanity is waning. But I digress. When it comes to these latest CDC guidelines, what do you think about them? Do you think that this should have happened earlier?
Well, it's interesting because we do have guidelines that are changing day to day. And so you can get whiplash just looking left and right at trying to keep up with them all. But they are evidence-based, and it's based on the changing nature of the pandemic and that we're learning new things all the time. So, you know, way back then, way back in January of 2020, we weren't recommending for the general public to be wearing masks. And now we've learned that masks are extremely effective in terms of preventing transmission. And then once we had the vaccines, we thought, well, the vaccines work great. So if you're fully vaccinated, you don't need to wear a mask. And now we've got the Delta variant, which is twice as infectious as previous strains. And so really, if we want to tamp down this latest surge of infections, it just makes sense for everybody to wear a mask.
Yeah, I think with that, one of the bigger topics now that's being discussed or even being debated are breakthrough cases. So can you just help unpack that a little bit and put that into context as it relates to what we know now with COVID?
So no vaccine works 100%. And we know that with the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, we've seen protection around 90 to 95%. And that works well, but you can get the breakthrough infections. Of course, any infection can overcome immunity if you have a high enough exposure, a high concentration that you're exposed to for a long time. So when you do get these breakthrough infections, the good news is that they're milder than they would be in case you weren't vaccinated. This is similar to influenza vaccine, where we have a much higher rate of breakthrough illness, but if you're vaccinated, you have milder disease. Since you have milder disease, there's a lower concentration of the virus, about 4 to 8-fold less of the virus in respiratory secretions, and this results in about a 90% decrease in transmission, risk of transmission to others. But there still is a risk of transmission to others. So again, you know, doing the vaccine and the mask will further decrease spread of the virus.
The CDC says even vaccinated people can also spread the Delta variant similar to the unvaccinated. If you can just expand on that a little bit further.
Yeah, so vaccinated people, if they have breakthrough infection, it may be symptomatic or asymptomatic. The vaccines protect about 90% against symptomatic infection, and similarly, they protect about 90% against asymptomatic infection also. The majority of transmission occurs among asymptomatic individuals, either before they become symptomatic or for those individuals who never become symptomatic. So that's how vaccinated people, if they do have either symptomatic or asymptomatic infection, they are at risk for transmitting to others, although much less so compared to unvaccinated individuals.
You know, we also kind of have always had this idea of herd immunity. Is that even still possible? What level of vaccination rates, especially with the Delta variant, what we need to achieve to beat this virus?
Well, initially, we were hearing numbers like 75% immunization rates would lead to herd immunity. But remember that herd immunity is based on several different factors. It depends on how many contacts we have. It depends on the infectiousness of the agent and also the durability of the immunity. With a more infectious strain circulating, the Delta variant, the 75% then goes up to about 90 or 95% immunity that you need within the general population. And herd immunity, really all that means is that we stop widespread transmission when a case is introduced. It doesn't mean that we eliminate transmission. It just means that when a case is introduced into a community, that there's very limited spread. So that's what we're looking at. We need a very high rate of immunity to have limited spread within our communities.
And not everyone is currently eligible. For those who are, when it comes to vaccination rates for younger people ages 12 and up, it remains low. So for those who believe children or younger people will manage COVID if they get it better than older people, what do you say to them?
Well, they do. They do manage it better. So the younger children are less at risk for severe disease, but they still are at risk. So we know that young children, that thousands of them have been admitted to the hospital in the U.S., hundreds of them have died. They have a risk of having the post-infectious multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, MISC. So they can still be affected, and they can also transmit to others who are vulnerable. So we really need to make sure that everybody is protected, and that's why we need to have vaccine available for the younger children also, and we're looking forward to that.
One kind of silver lining is while hospitalizations are up, deaths from COVID remain relatively low, especially when you compare to earlier this year. What does that tell you?
I think what it shows is that the vaccines have reached a large portion of the population. In California, 62% of people are fully vaccinated and over 9% are partially vaccinated. And with those who are vaccinated, if they do get COVID, it's going to be a mild disease. It's going to be a cold where they have to stay home for a few days, but that's about it. And the vast majority of them are not going to be hospitalized. So the only way you're going to end up in the hospital or die from COVID these days is if you're not vaccinated. So that's why I think this latest surge, although we are seeing increased cases, I don't anticipate that we're going to see the hospitals and ICUs filling up rapidly.
Well, families are preparing for school reopenings from K through 12 to the university level. When it comes to Cal State universities, as well as the UC system, now state workers and healthcare workers are going to be required to get vaccines. Are you hopeful that this will kind of put a dent in the sharp spike in cases, especially now that the CDC is also requiring masking at schools like K through 12, regardless of vaccination status?
Yeah, I mean, vaccine is the first line of defense, and masking is really the second line. So the combination of the two of them is like having airbags in your car and then also wearing a seatbelt. So it really ensures the safest environment possible. So the more institutions that require vaccine, I think that's great because it increases the vaccination rates. We know that from previous experience. So requiring the vaccine and requiring masking will make a safer environment for everybody.
Finally, we just got more information out this morning. Pfizer's looking to apply for emergency authorization for a third booster shot. What are you hearing about this? And do you think booster shots are likely in our future, not only for Pfizer, but Moderna and potentially Johnson & Johnson?
Yeah, I think everybody's going to need a booster shot at some point. The question is really when, and will it be an updated vaccine with the latest variants? So I don't know how long the vaccines are going to last. We just are learning of blood tests, serologic correlates of immunity, so that we can measure when people are likely to be susceptible to infection again. And we just still don't know. So the first group that will likely get recommendations for boosters is probably people with weakened immune systems. And then following that, we might get recommendations for those over 65. And then after that, some recommendations for those in the general population. But I'm just not sure when those recommendations are going to be made, when we're going to have enough data.
Dr. Blumberg, always a pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. Dean Blumberg is Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Medical Center. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're joined now by CAP Radio's politics reporter, Nicole Nixon, who brings us an update on the vaccine guidance for California state and healthcare workers. Nicole, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Did you sleep much last night?
Yes.
Good. Okay, so this isn't a vaccine mandate. So can you just explain what will be required of state workers?
Sure. And this applies to more than just state workers. It applies to people who work in healthcare and congregate settings like jails and nursing homes, too. They now have to show proof of vaccination to their employer. And if they don't have that vaccine card, they'll have to go in for regular coronavirus testing at least once a week, more often, maybe twice a week if they work directly with patients. And they'll also have to keep wearing masks or appropriate PPE at work if they have not been vaccinated.
Are officials hoping for a surge in vaccinations now that the honor system is no longer in place?
Well, that's certainly what they're hoping. A memo from the state HR agency that went out to state workers said that this new requirement is because of the overwhelming majority of new cases that's appearing in unvaccinated people. A healthcare worker union said that, you know, they're hoping this would help nudge hesitant employees. And Governor Newsom was asked yesterday if he would ever throw in the towel and just say there's no convincing some people to get the vaccine. He said no, he would never give up trying to convince people that the vaccine is safe and that they should get it.
Well, given that some people are still hesitant, what are some of the reactions you're hearing in regards to this new check on vaccination status?
You know, the New York Times had a really good story out yesterday about what workers thought of this new announcement. It talks about how there are pockets of vaccine skeptical workers, even among hospital employees who've been living the last 18 months of COVID. But most workers' unions as a whole seem okay with this requirement and have said they think it's a good compromise. I will say the largest state workers' union, the SEIU Local 1000, sent a cease and desist letter to the state, not necessarily over these new requirements, but they're upset that they weren't consulted and that this came down with such short notice.
Well, with that, I mean, just politically speaking, I mean, there is a recall election coming up in just about 7 weeks. I'm sure you are very well aware of that. how is this move playing out with those who want to recall the governor?
The governor's political opponents, you know, recall candidates, they're saying that, you know, the state doesn't need mandates, that people should be trusted to make their own decisions. Some of the recall candidates, I haven't seen weigh in on this, actually, but you know, Newsom supporters definitely backed this move. I saw a lot of praise for this decision, both statewide and nationally. And then you mentioned the similar policies with Cal State University. I think this helped push other employers to adopt these policies, although the CSU system was talking about it before. But you also saw cities like LA and Long Beach announce similar policies, too, for their city employees to get vaccinated or get tested very frequently.
You know, obviously, the governor's he's traveling up and down the state, and his tone over the past few days has become, you know, more deliberate, aggressive and pointed, calling out vaccine information, especially those from on the extreme right and even calling out national politicians. What are your thoughts on this? Is this just all part of a calculated political strategy?
You know, I think yes and no, it is part of a political strategy. I think the governor sounded genuinely frustrated the other day when he was talking about vaccine misinformation and the people with high platforms who are perpetuating it. He got into a Twitter fight with Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. She has compared mask requirements to segregation. But the next day he was fundraising off that Twitter feud and asking for donations, saying, you know, these are the people I'm fighting against in this recall. So yes and no, he is frustrated, but it also is a political strategy.
Yesterday, we had a segment about voter turnout and potentially tepid voter enthusiasm going into September. What do you think Newsom has to do to activate Democrats or just voters across the state, just to, or especially his base, to show up on Election Day?
I think he should spend some of that money. He has raised more than $30 million to fight this recall. I've seen a few ads, but not a very aggressive, you know, campaign yet. He's giving the same line when he's asked about the recall, that this is just a Republican power grab. And I'm not sure that that is really hitting voters. I think that, you know, we're talking about Democratic complacency. I think that that actually might be contributing to that a little bit, because Democrats might think, oh, there's no way that Republicans could grab this power or win this recall. But, you know, now that we're faced with the recall and seeing who is really motivated to turn out, that line might actually be contributing to some of the problem. But I guess we'll have to see.
Nicole, always a pleasure having you on Insight.
Thank you so much.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's politics reporter and co-host of California State of Mind. And our segment on voter turnout for the upcoming recall election will air tomorrow. Up next, why certain zip codes have lower vaccination rates than others in the region, and what community leaders are doing to help dispel misinformation. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The vaccination rate in Sacramento County is just above 50%. Good, right? Well, there are pockets throughout the county that have much lower vaccination rates. Cap Radio reporters Sammy Kayola and Janelle Salonga join us now with their reporting after they took a dive into the data. Welcome to Insight, Sammy and Janelle.
Hey, thanks for having us, Vicki.
Well, looking at the public health data, what kind of disparities are we seeing in terms of vaccination rates by area?
There's a really large range, Vicki. In areas like Midtown and Rancho Cordova, which are the most vaccinated in the city and of Sacramento, the city of Sacramento and Sacramento County, you're seeing over 70% of folks vaccinated. But compare that to places like North Highlands, where only 31% to 35% of people are vaccinated. And
that's less than half. Yeah.
And in other areas of the city, like Arden Arcade or Del Paso Heights, Valley High, you know, those numbers are still in the mid to low 40s. And that actually tracks along a lot of racial and class divisions. So if you take like Rancho Cordova, for example, the median household income in 2019 was $133,000 compared to North Highlands, where that in that same year, the median household income was $33,000. So that's a huge difference. And, you know, those communities that I named earlier, like Del Paso Heights, Arden Arcade, Valley High, these are majority non-white communities where, you know, Midtown and Rancho Cordova, a large percentage of the population is white. In a higher proportion there than the county average.
Sammy, how did you become aware of this story and where did it lead you?
We had this hunch that there was a ton of work going on the ground to try to educate people in these communities. You know, in speaking to public health, they told us that they were setting up all of these vaccination sites, but what they really needed were partners in certain neighborhoods, these sort of churches and community centers and nonprofit groups that could do the work of actually having one-on-one conversations with people to try to just convince person by person to protect themselves and their communities. And so we wanted to go talk to those people, those boots on the ground people. So Janelle and I went to Arden Arcade, which they mentioned earlier has rates in the low 40s. There are a lot of immigrants and refugees in Arden Arcade, especially from Middle Eastern communities. We went to Del Paso Heights, which is a largely Black neighborhood in North Sacramento. Ton of pride there around Grant Union High School. It's a really close-knit community. And we went to Valley High, which is in South Sacramento, which is home to a lot of Asian American Pacific Islander residents. So we just went to, as I said, community centers. We went to a pharmacy. We went to a family resource center and just tried to figure out what kind of challenge these leaders are facing and what they're hearing from residents.
I mean, while the two of you are just really hitting foot to pavement and listening to people in these neighborhoods, what were they telling you about the reasons behind the low rates?
So one of the big reasons, Vicky, was that there was a lot of misinformation and sort of misconceptions around the safety of the vaccine.
I don't feel it's a bad thing to take it. I'm just not sure if it's gonna react to my body the way it reacts to certain people. It might be really helping people. I'm not sure, but my fear is like, what will really happen to me? You know, at the end of the day, I got to live with me. If something happens to me, you know, who's gonna take care of my kids?
Yeah, Janelle, what I'm hearing is uncertainty.
Makes sense, because there is a lot of information out there and it can be a lot to sift through. But, you know, more people in California have died from COVID-19 in the past 13 days than the number of people who have died from, you know, post-vaccination infection in the past 7 months. So, you know, there's been 93 people or so who have died in California post-vaccination in the past 7 months. But the number of people who have, you know, passed on from COVID in the past 30 days is much higher than that. So we're seeing that, you know, the vaccine is helping. But again, like I mentioned before, it can be really tough to sift through all the information that is provided, especially if it's coming through in a format that maybe is really overwhelming, you know, such as just like information being thrown at you all the time.
When you're talking with other people throughout the neighborhoods that you were walking around, what were the other reasons why they haven't gotten vaccinated yet?
A big reason was just the history of medical racism in America. You know, there's a huge precedent of non-white people, specifically Black folks, you know, experiencing mistreatment at the hands of not just specific doctors, but the medical system.
For years and years and years, I'm gonna just tell them like it is. For years and years and years, Black people have been nothing but test dummies and experiments. They've been giving us drugs, they've been giving us diseases to see how bad the effects are, but they never gave anything for to us that, you know, that could be some kind of cure or treatment. So for those reasons, I chose to not get the vaccination.
Yeah. And so what he's talking about there is the Tuskegee experiment in the 1930s, during which, you know, the U.S. government spent 40 years experimenting on Black men to cure, quote unquote, bad blood, but didn't tell those men that they had syphilis and never intended to cure them. And so the experiment lasted around 40 years. But by then, you know, 128 of the men had died from syphilis or related complications, and many of their family members were infected. So, you know, there is that mistrust. And public health advocates in the county and, you know, in those neighborhoods say that it's the onus is on healthcare professionals to work towards rebuilding that trust and showing people that, you know, this vaccine and just the medical system is something that these communities can trust will actually help them when they are sick.
Yeah, to prove they're worthy of trust. Sammy, were there accessibility issues when you were talking to people? I mean, is the vaccine logistically widely available for people?
It really depends on how you live, on where you live. Early on, when the vaccine was just coming out, it was very difficult for some people to find a place that they could actually get to, you know, and public transit was limited during a lot of the pandemic. And so people that don't have vehicles, they just struggled to find somewhere where they could walk. That has gotten a little bit better as the county has created more pop-up vaccine sites. I know the Pinnell Center in South Sacramento has been a huge asset for people in that area. But, you know, a lot of families, they have two working parents or they just have one parent, and it's hard to get away, especially if there are loved children in the home. It's hard to find the time to go and get a vaccine. Then you might be nervous about being sick in the following days and that affecting your ability to provide for your family. So we talked to someone at a family resource center who said, you know, they were trying to provide, you know, free lift passes. They were trying to get childcare help for people. And also, you know, there are a lot of folks that just don't have the broadband necessary to make online appointments, or they're not sure how to navigate online enrollment sites. And so you've got people, community leaders who are just calling families one by one and saying, okay, I found an appointment for you. Can you make it? Your ride will be here at this time. You know, call us back if you have any issues. They're really doing it one by one. And when I was in Arden Arcade, we actually heard a lot of concerns around, what documentation do I need? Do I need a state ID? Do I need insurance? Actually, while I was interviewing a pharmacist, somebody came in, it was a young woman, and she had an older, her dad with her. And she said, hey, my dad doesn't have insurance. Can he still get the vaccine? And we just, you know, saw her educate that family on the spot to say, no, you don't need insurance. It is free for everybody. You don't necessarily need an identification. And so, you know, I think a lot of community leaders are just trying to take down any barriers, any perceived barriers, but there are real financial barriers as well.
Yeah, when you just sharing that anecdote, you also just think about, you know, the people that don't have that opportunity to speak with a pharmacist to kind of help guide them through, you know, they don't need an insurance or state ID, or thinking that the vaccine costs money when it actually doesn't.
No, it doesn't. It's being, you know, provided by the government, which, you know, hopefully will make it more accessible for people, but it's not widely known that it's free in some neighborhoods.
When it comes to solutions, what strategies have actually worked?
So like I mentioned before, you know, it can be overwhelming for a lot of folks to have all this information kind of in front of them and not know where to start. And so a big thing that we heard is that educating people in the way that works for them and sort of meeting people where they are is really important. And so in Del Paso Heights, we spoke with Dr. Gina Warren, who founded a foundation that is helping to educate a lot of the folks in the community by having these roundtable discussions and creating materials like TikToks and videos that can be more accessible to folks in the community.
So what does educate mean? It's not just handing out pamphlets, because we have people who can't read. It's not just a language barrier. There is a language barrier even within English. You have to understand literacy. You have to understand the literacy levels in this community, and not just that, hand out a bunch of pamphlets and do the typical things. You got to be boots on the ground. You got to sit down and have conversations with people, and it has to be ongoing.
Yeah, I mean, if there's language barriers, I mean, that's obviously going to be a consequence of that, can be not trusting what you're hearing when it comes to the vaccine and getting vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And, you know, I think it helps for, you know, Dr. Warren that she and her staff at the Neighborhood Wellness Foundation have been in Del Paso Heights, you know, for generations. You know, they have that family connection there. And so they have, you know, a history of understanding the community. And another thing that's helped is with trusted messengers. So people hearing from someone they know that, you know, the vaccine helped them, or they feel safer after taking the vaccine. Bobby Dalton Guling Roy is the site manager at the Tete Pediatric Clinic COVID-19 testing site. And so they say that a lot of people in the community that they serve have come up to them and told them, you know, that a family member or somebody that they trusted has helped, like, kind of alleviate their concerns around the vaccine.
Other folks say, like, I just need my pastor to tell me to take it, or my priest to tell me to take it, and I'll do it. Or, you know, in the Filipino community in particular, like I said, we have a lot of nurses, and and they carry a lot of weight, you know, in our community. They're trusted healthcare professionals. And so, you know, if they give the word, a lot of people will listen to them.
You know, Sammy, that reminds me of the vaccine incentives that the state was doing. Did you chat with anyone about that and if they thought that was actually effective?
Yeah, so the pharmacist that we interviewed in Arden-Arcade said that was a game changer at her pharmacy. They started on May 27th offering $50 gift cards to folks who got their second shots. And she said they definitely saw an uptick after that. And she was excited to be able to offer that. But we also spoke to some community leaders who don't like that idea. They don't think it's a real investment in their communities. This is Gina Warren again from the Neighborhood Wellness Foundation in El Paso Heights.
I don't agree with handing out $100 gift cards, because the amount of money that they spend on those gift cards, they could be actually putting back in the community. They could, you know, with the large number of gift cards that you have to put out, you can start focusing on affordable housing, looking at all those other social determinants that impact health. Yes, this is more urgent, but you're not going to just force people to do that, because I feel like you're utilizing and you're taking advantage of the needs of the community, because most people could use that $100. They could use that.
Well, in the last...
So there's this...
Sorry, Vicky. Keep going, Sammy.
I was just going to follow up and say that Gina really wants to see a longer term commitment to her neighborhood. She doesn't want this to be sort of a pop-in, pop-out situation.
Yeah. And I guess what I was going to say, just looking ahead to the future and the weeks and months ahead, and in about the last 30 seconds or so, what Sacramento County, what conversations are taking place within the county to combat this problem?
They're actually training trusted messengers in communities right now. They're calling them vaccine ambassadors. There are going to be about 30 of them from a handful of underserved neighborhoods. The county's actually going to pay them to do this education, and they're just going to be armed with a list of clinics and a list of, you know, accurate information about the vaccine, and just get the message out. It is safe. It is the best thing you can do to protect yourself and others.
Sammy and Janelle, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Vicky.
Of course. Thank you.
And that is CAP Radio reporters Sammy Cayola and Janelle Salonga on their reporting of low vaccination pockets in Sacramento and solutions to curb the hesitancy. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Well, last March, it seemed like the world stopped, and we're talking March of 2020, and it really did for an overwhelming number of small businesses. Now, over a month into reopening, the businesses left standing have a new obstacle. They're struggling to find employees to fill the positions left open 16 months ago. Juan Barajas is the co-owner of Savory Cafe in Woodland, which is in Yolo County. He, his wife Kristen Hansen, and brother Toby shouldered the entire operation of the restaurant when they laid off their staff. We're also going to hear from Rami Hosen. He is the co-founder of Saha Float Spa, which opened in Midtown Sacramento in the middle of the pandemic. For Rami and his sister Ellen, finding staff when they first opened was easier than it is now.
My name is Juan Barajas. My wife and I are the owners of Savory Cafe. And we've been established Savory Cafe in 2015. And we're reestablishing Savory Cafe in 2021. After last year, after the pandemic, we really had to adapt and change and reinvent our whole operation and the way that we do business at our restaurant. Just like many other restaurants, we suffered a big loss when it came to revenue, to income, layoffs of our staff. We've went through many different changes throughout the pandemic in order to continue to serve and in order to keep our restaurant alive. So that's the way that I mean reestablishing our restaurant. It's a new way of doing business. The way I see it, the whole restaurant industry has been changed and will forever be impacted and changed due to the coronavirus. So we have to find new creative ways in order to keep our restaurants alive, in order to do business in the restaurant world. We had to start laying off employees back in March. It was a very hard decision for us to make. We are a very small operation, but we had 14 employees, and we had to lay them all off. So after June 15th, when everything reopened, we were trying to prepare ourselves to hire additional staff to serve not only our existing guests. We knew that a lot of the restrictions perhaps were going away, and that we could actually serve our customers a little bit better. And it would be a matter of individuals who are eager to come back to work. And we had to put a couple ads, but we had seen the previous weeks, just like we see sometimes at the restaurant, that there's slower periods of times for business. We noticed that it was a little bit difficult to start hiring, and we're not looking at the same amount of applications that we traditionally see. At any given time, we have about 7 to 10 applications at the restaurant, and we were not seeing that. We usually check with other restaurants in the community. We have a pretty good network of restaurant owners and chefs. Woodland's a very small community. It's a very tight community, and we stay in touch with a lot of the different restaurants downtown, and we have those conversations. Are you having those same problems? We would ask ourselves. It seemed like at this time, we were all having labor issues, labor shortages, and we thought it was due to the fact that we were all hiring after June 15th and preparing our businesses. But the hardest thing has been getting those applications in. The unfortunate thing is that they are not coming in. We're not receiving those applications. We're not able to be fully staffed. We're having a huge, huge problem with individuals showing up for those interviews, showing up for any positions that are available. And I don't understand why the industry has been hit so hard at this point. And I know there's individuals out there who are willing and or who are able to do the work. I think it's an unwillingness to come back into work. And we have about 3-4 positions that we can fill immediately. I could have filled about a month ago. And that's because we just did a little bit of hiring last week, and we just filled two positions that we needed, that were, like, I would say, highly essential, highly critical. People have come in and applied. We have offered them a particular position, and we've had people not show up on their first day of work. So that plays, I mean, that really irritates me, because it's almost a letdown. It feels like a slap in the face, to be honest with you, to know that there's individuals that are coming in and they're filling out some particular paperwork that says they came to apply, and but we've offered those positions. I really do feel irritated, because I feel like I was cheated out of an hour that I could have used for prep, that I needed to be in my kitchen doing some prep work, that my manager could have had in order to move our business forward, that my chef could have used to continue training. And it really breaks my heart to know that individuals do not have the decency and the dignity to just accept, not necessarily accept a position, but be bold enough to tell us, like, you know what, I don't want to take this job, and be able to do that. And now we're put in a really hard position where we have to close our restaurants due to the lack. Someone needs to take a vacation. Someone is ill. And what do we do, because we are so short-staffed? And that's where we find ourselves at this particular week. You know, starting on Wednesday, which are our regular operational hours, we'll be closed at the restaurant from July 27th through August 3rd. So we are having to close for mental health. Everybody needs a little bit of break. Everybody is so overworked. We've had a couple instances where we have offered a position and individuals just plain do not show up. But individuals, it seems like it's taking a little bit a while before they're coming into work, or they are not ready to enter the workforce. I can't force that. I can't force someone to take a position, and I cannot make them come to work.
My name is Rami Hossein. I'm co-founder of Saha Float Spa in Midtown Sacramento. And we've been open for approaching a year now. We have our 1-year anniversary in a few weeks. Opening during the pandemic was you know, it was a whirlwind of, it was a roller coaster ride. You know, there were a lot of unforeseen challenges. You know, the mask mandate, we made sure we followed pretty rigorously, but, you know, as for a spa, everyone has their own comfort level with, you know, what they're willing to do and experience. And, you know, our sanitation guidelines were, you know, pretty top notch. So we had to, you know, make sure that everything was super clean and sanitary. But, you know, opening during the pandemic, yeah, lots of obstacles along the way. Our hiring process, I would say, was easier when we first opened up, even though it was in the middle of the pandemic. I will say, you know, in the early start, we were looking to hire and we would get probably 2 to 3 times more people interviewing than we needed, which was fantastic. And we could go through an interview and be extremely selective. I would say now the hiring process is a little bit different in that I would say we're seeing about a third of the applicants that we've seen in the past. But I've also noticed that the applicants that we are getting now are, you know, genuinely interested in working with us and have put in a little bit more thought into wanting to work with us. So that's actually been a good thing as well. The biggest thing for us and the biggest difference that we've seen at Saha is, you know, we're looking to hire three to four people to work in anticipation of, you know, fall and winter months being a little bit more busy. But, you know, we're only getting a third of, you know, the applicants that we would historically see in the past. What we have experienced is when we've interviewed a couple folks who we extend an offer to and then, you know, retroactively decide to work elsewhere. I think the main driving force for that is they're looking for, you know, something that is within the realm of, you know, what they studied in undergrad or college or a higher degree. So, that's what we've seen in terms of, you know, once we've extended an offer to potential employees, a couple folks have, you know, taken jobs elsewhere, which really does force us to think about, you know, what it is that we can provide as a small business who has, you know, just opened up. So our outreach for looking for employees is a little bit different in that we start internally to see if we have, you know, members that have expressed interest or, you know, friends of current employees, because we found that to be the most fruitful. And then from there, we will either send out a post through Instagram or other social media. And then we'll send out maybe an email through our listserv. We don't extend it past that just because we really do want to find folks who are familiar with floating and who have, you know, some ties to the community already and some interest with floating. And so that's what we've done. And historically, that's been enough. And I think it still will be enough. But, you know, moving forward, it might just take a little bit longer to find the right, you know, person or persons to be able to invest that time and energy in training them, and so that they can provide great service to our guests and members. But we're definitely seeing a decline in the number of applicants that we've seen compared to historic numbers. You know, I think the reason why we're not seeing as many applicants now is a combination of things. I think people have been, you know, stuck at home and working from home for a while. And I think they're, now that things are opening back up, they're looking to, you know, just explore and travel and, you know, work remotely if they're able to do that. And so, you know, small businesses that require employees to be in-house is a little bit more difficult to find nowadays. I would say that's probably one driving factor. And then the other thing is, you know, we're a small business that has just opened up. And so, you know, it's not necessarily the highest paying job, but at the same time, it's on us to provide a great culture for our employees and to provide them a way to grow. And so that's what we've been focusing on in order to, you know, be a little bit more competitive in this arena.
And that was Juan Barajas, owner of Savory Cafe, and Rami Hosen, co-founder of Saha Float Spa, both taking time out of their busy schedules, sharing their struggles to regain employees. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Inside on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This Sunday, you can enjoy a free concert in Nevada City, the Sierra Jazz Society Picnic. And although this is the inaugural picnic, the Sierra Jazz Society was created nearly 20 years ago by flutist Nora Nosbaum and her husband and bassist, Bill Douglas. Joining us now is Nora, who will also be honored for her contributions at the picnic this weekend. Nora, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me, Cynthia.
Cynthia is our producer. I am Vicky, but we are a tight-knit team here.
Thanks for having me, Vicky.
Oh, we are happy to have you. What does it feel like, you know, nearly 20 years later to have a picnic and concert in your honor?
Well, it's really in Bill's honor, but I'm overwhelmed, actually. I have handed over the reins of Sierra Jazz Society to three fantastic and competent people, and they're putting on this concert in honor of Bill and me at Pioneer Park in Nevada City at 6 o'clock. And it is a picnic, so I hope people will bring blankets or chairs so you have some place to sit. It is free, but they're hoping for donations, of course.
Well, let's actually play some of the music, kind of a preview to this picnic. So you and your husband and John Gearton performing Softly as in a Morning Sunrise. Let's take a listen.
Okay.
Nora, do you get nostalgic listening to that?
Well, that I'm going to play that tune this Sunday, so I'm not sure nostalgia is really part of this, but I'm
looking forward to it.
The three of us did play together for 15 years every month at Summer Times, which is now closed, a great restaurant that was up here in Nevada County. This concert is really, I'm so excited for it because there are some really great musicians. In fact, they're all great musicians. They're three headliners. Claire D, a vocalist from San Francisco who has performed all over the world. Beth Duncan, another vocalist, a Sacramento favorite, and I just love her singing. And also Ruth Davies, bassist from the Bay Area, who's played with Charles Brown, Maria Muldaur, and Elvin Bishop, and a whole list of people too long to name. And it is a tribute to my husband, Bill Douglas, who, well, he has Parkinson's now. He's being cared for at Crystal Ridge in Grass Valley. But Bill played and recorded with some great musicians, Marion McPartland, Tom Waits, Mose Allison, and a whole bunch of other people. His resume is unbelievable. And he can still play, and he's going to play Sunday. And he's going to play this tune you just heard. We're going to play that Sunday as our opening one.
Well, that's a great preview, and I wish you all the best. It's going to be a lot of fun this weekend. And so for those who are interested, the Sierra Jazz Society Picnic is a free concert this Sunday in Nevada City. Nora Nosbaum, a pleasure having you on Insight.
Thank you. Can I just mention the website?
We have just about 10 seconds left to the show, but we have it as a link on capradio.org/insight. We're going to end with Beth Duncan's I'm All Yours. I'm Vicky Gonzalez, and this is Insight on Cap Radio. Have a great day.
I'm all yours. Make no mistake.